Hello and welcome to Big Mouth with me, Andrew Harrison, and Sean Pattenden, the festive Shania Twain to my Michael Bublé. Hello, Sean. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. I love Michael Bublé, you know, secretly.
He seems to be a nice bloke, although I cannot stand or abide the music. What are we doing this week?
Well, funny you should ask. Happy Winterval to everybody. It's Christmas, which means the first of our annual roundups of the best and most recommendable stuff of the year. Luckily, we are free of the paper's requirement to talk about what's important this year, and we can discuss what we really like instead. We have two of our recurring guests choose their best records, TV, films and other stuff from the year. Andrew Muller is a recovering pop journo who edited the Melody Maker review section in the early 90s. Yes, in his childhood in Wagga Wagga, New South Wales, he was bitten by a radioactive copy of Roland Barthes' Mythologies. He's the author of several books, including It's Too Late to Die Young Now, Misadventures in Rock and Roll, and he's also a proper journo, reporting from dozens of increasingly dangerous countries and presenting the foreign desk on globe-trotting radio station Monocle 24. Hello, Andrew Muller. Welcome to Big Mouth.
Thank you. It's delightful to be back.
As an Australian, how are you feeling about this grim Christmassy time of year?
Like going back to Australia, which is
can we come too, please?
Yes, because Australia's become such a model for sane, stable politics. We're on our 47th Prime Minister in the last 6 weeks.
Doesn't everybody in the country have to have a go at what
I'm Well, yeah, I'm about to make my annual Christmas lurch back home, and I am slightly worried that it's going to be quite difficult to get through 3 consecutive weeks in Australia without being asked to take a crack at running a place for at least one afternoon.
Well, maybe. And tell us, when do you go to Australia? You don't spend Christmas Day here on purpose, is that right?
I don't spend Christmas Day anywhere. It's actually pretty fantastic. If you're flying to the east coast of Australia and you leave London on the afternoon of Christmas Eve, you arrive in Melbourne or Sydney, in this instance it will be Melbourne, on the morning of Boxing Day. You've missed the whole thing. You've got everybody's Christmas lunch leftovers and the test match on television. Okay. It's fantastic.
Come up smiling on Tuesday.
Exactly.
In the Melody Maker days, were you ever dragooned into those festive features where you put a hat on one of Tinder sticks?
Yes.
And they stand there looking really, really happy.
It's all coming back to me now. I did a Christmas feature on the Wonder Stuff, who we dressed up as a nativity scene. If I recall rightly, Miles Hunt got the Virgin Mary role. Not that he bothered to shave for the occasion,
right?
I did the perhaps in retrospect mildly blasphemous Wonder Stuff Christmas nativity.
Fantastic. Where does such fun take place now? We don't have the weeklies.
I don't know.
Does Pitchfork do it?
Do people still do that? I can't remember if it was the same year, but there was a year where we put REM on the Christmas cover. Alan Jones, our editor, whose book I do recommend, went to Athens to do the story. And the photos are delightful because Michael Stipe turned up at the photo shoot with all these wacky Christmas costumes.
So he was into it.
Yeah. The other 3 members of REM slightly less so, and our fabulous photographer Kevin Westenberg, I think, definitely not, because he wanted to take all these beautiful artsy portraits of REM, which he did, and which we did use. But we did run some pictures of Peter Buck wearing a bear costume without the head and looking like he earnestly wished he was a very long way away.
That's the kind of thing that would end up on the cover of an REM album, let alone the cover of the
The pictures of the rest of REM reluctantly dressed up as elves and bears and Santa Claus while Stipe beamed cheerfully were glorious.
Absolutely. But we, the audience, do expect that pop stars go into the business wanting to dress up as Father Christmas on the Christmas editions of magazines, don't we?
We never asked Lou Reed or Van Morrison.
Van Morrison kind of went near there, didn't he, with his purple velour jumpsuit in The Last Waltz when he high kicks his way across the stage at the end of Caravan. You know, it's a short step from there to dressing as Father Christmas.
I think I'm right in recalling, at the risk of prompting further correspondence from Van Morrison's learned friends, that we did actually get letters from his solicitor when, on our funny pages, we did a series of running gags of Van Morrison as Santa Claus. And we did get letters inviting us to cease and desist.
I can imagine happily sitting on Van Morrison's knee and asking for an Xbox. Also sharing their favourites, you heard him just then. It's Michael Hand, former music editor at The Guardian, now writing about pop and related matters for The Financial Times, The Spectator, Classic Rock, and yes, The Guardian too. He is an unreconstructed Def Leppard fan and an unrepentant supporter of QPR. Hello, Michael. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas to you too, Andrew.
Now, your big achievement this year was getting 21st century Hogarth Cold War Steve into The Economist. How did you pull that off?
Well, do you know, I actually pitched it to the FT first because I thought there's something happening here with Cold War Steve and with Idols and Sleaford Mods, and I coined this idea of furious absurdism. I pitched it to the FT as an essay for the front of Life and Arts, thinking they'll go for this. They went, no, not really heard of any of these people, sorry.
FT hasn't heard of the Idols and Sleaford Mods. I can't believe that.
I've certainly reviewed Idols for the FT.
I mean, Lionel Barber speaks of little else, I understand.
And I thought, well, where can I write this for? I've been writing for various bits of The Economist. It's an incredibly complicated organisation where there appear to be like 45 different blogs that you write for, all of which pay different sums. But the person I was writing for on Prospero, their arts website, said they're interested in having something by you in print. So I sent off this idea about Cold War Stephen Furious Absurdism to the arts editor, who then referred it to the UK news editor. So a piece about Cold War Steve's exhibition at The Social went in the UK news section of The Economist, the hard news bit at the front.
I like the idea that, you know, it's going around on the Treasury brief in the morning. That, you know, the Monetary Policy Committee has gone, this appears to be Jacob Rees-Mogg throwing a Frey Bentos pie at Steve McFadden. What does that say about confidence in business in our country at this stage?
It is one of the great joys, I think, of freelance journalism, though, those moments where you get something massively incongruous into a newspaper or magazine, something that just shouldn't be there.
It gives me enormous pleasure. The first thing I did for The Spectator was about kind of a notional upsurge in glam that I'd basically invented. But I got HMLTD into The Spectator, which is fantastic.
You also managed to get Lawrence from Denham and Go-Kart Mozart into The Spectator.
Yes!
How did you do that?
Well, what have you got on the table that they will let you write these things?
Lawrence, The Spectator... I don't want to speak ill of people who pay me, but we all know that the front half of The Spectator perhaps contains views with which we wouldn't be happy to be seen expressing ourselves.
Marketplace of ideas.
But the art section is fantastic. I've got to say, it's a really good art section. It's probably the best art section in print at the moment. And they're up for interesting stories. And you can't deny that Lawrence isn't an interesting story. I mean, it's an amazing story.
Yes.
I don't think we need to go through it for the benefit of listeners. Just Google Lawrence Spectator and you can read it.
If they're listening to this, they know Lawrence. They definitely are on board.
So I spent an hour and a half in Lawrence's council flat in near the Barbican with him unloading on me about why he still felt he could become a pop star. Me, my jaw dropping. You can't become a pop star. It's too late.
22-year-olds can't become pop stars.
But it ended up being the top of the most read panel in The Spectator for 2 weeks, so I think it's just the strength of the story. One of the guys from Cherry Red told me that Lawrence had popped into the office after that. He'd been emailing me while Lawrence was there, and I said, "Did you know it's the most read thing in The Spectator?" He said, "Really?" And then he emailed me half an hour later, said, "Yeah, Lawrence made me print out the panel where it is most read in The Spectator so he could take it home and put it on his wall."
So this means that somewhere in the world, tacky is getting down to...
Forever breathe the lonely word right now.
I'm thinking more like denim on ice and the new potatoes and middle of the road and the Osmonds. I think. But if it becomes, you know, now that, as you know from The Guardian, editors really pay attention to those most read things. It's just going to move the needle of The Spectator. Maybe a bit less free market liberalism, neo-fascism and a little...
They've asked me to do a 3,000-word retrospective on The Servants coming up. Yeah, so a lot of Phil King in that issue.
Fantastic. Yeah, space to fill, etc. Anyway, Andrew and Michael are going to tell us their favourite stuff from the year later on in the show. And so is Sian, because it's her turn. But first, she's going to tell you this.
Remember, you can get a little bit more big mouth, which isn't very grammatical, is it, in your inbox every week if you support the show by pledging us a few quid on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. We record an exclusive extra bit for Patreon supporters after every show and ping it by the miracle of electronic mail. Help us cover our studio costs with the equivalent of a price of a pint. Let's face it, you wouldn't drink anything that costs less than a fiver, would you? And we will send you that extra bit every week. And if you have a spare moment, why not leave us a review and a star rating on Apple Podcasts as well? Search Patreon Big Mouth for the extra bit or go to the Big Mouth Facebook page to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
Okay, well, we've asked everyone to choose an album, a TV thing, a movie, and a track of the year, plus a one other miscellaneous from any category they like. I'm going to start with Michael Hand's selections. What films and telly did he like, and how is he going to get the 1975 and the Hold Steady in somehow? Here's some of his stuff. This is As a Man by Anna Calvi from Michael's album of the year, Hunter, then a taste of the final series of The Americans on TV, and then the movie Leave No Trace.
When you're not walking and talking as a man...
Talking about.
Something came up. One of our couriers went over to the Americans.
It's been a gold mine. We're gonna get the illegals here and all over the country based on what we're learning. The Russians are sitting down with us in public, negotiating this big treaty, but behind our backs, they're stealing our weapons and our technology. We've been mad about this a long time. I get why, but this is it now.
It's not a crime to be unhoused, but it's illegal to live on public land.
We have found an option.
Are we gonna be okay here?
Still think our own thoughts.
Keep pedaling. Look where you want to go.
School is about social skills, not just intellectual ones.
I think it might be easier on us if we try to adapt.
We're wearing their clothes, we're in their house, we're eating their food, we're doing their work. We have adapted. First of a thousand,
you're right on the wall. Pack your things.
Did you even try? Because I can't tell.
That was As a Man by Anna Calvi, followed by the trailers for TV series The Americans and the movie Leave No Trace. Anna Calvi, why is this your album of the year, Michael?
Oh, Anna Calvi's one of those people I sort of flitted around, kind of quite liking, always quite liking, think she's obviously a good thing, but without it ever really hitting home. But this album, I think, was everything that the earlier records had promised. Though, having read other people's reviews, I note that I appear to be alone in thinking this. Everyone else seemed to think it was just another Anna Calvi album.
It's big mouth, you can say what you like. You don't need to worry about what other people think.
That is actually almost literally what I thought of this album. I had previously admired her work and thought this is good and I'm glad it's there, but I don't really care about it. Whereas this one, I really enjoyed this record.
And there's one just stupendously good track on there, Swimming Pool, which is this fantastic, beautiful ballad, which was apparently inspired by David Hockney's 1960s pictures. And it sounds, it's hard to describe it, it sounds visual. It reminded me, not so much of Hockney, though, of those kind of Douglas Sirk 1950s melodramas, all the saturated colour. Yeah. And that's what came off for me through it. There are kind of infelicities here and there. You know, there's a chorus that goes, "I'm an alpha, I divide and conquer," which seems a bit, come on, work a bit harder. That's a bit student politics, yeah. But there's a kind of frank sexuality and sensuality. Mm-hmm. Be careful here. Going through it, that's absolutely intoxicating. I think she's a fantastically talented person. I hope this is the step that takes her into the kind of PJ Harvey, Nick Cave levels where she's been loitering below for some time.
It's like the good old days when people could make three records and not get noticed and then make the one that happens. Yeah. Like having to deliver immediately, otherwise, you know, new claims when no on a Monday for you.
Well, obviously, it helps if you're on an indie, as she is, that you don't get the instant pressure. And I think in terms of someone on Domino, she's probably done reasonably good business. And, of course, they have the Arctic Monkeys money to sustain the rest of the label. But this is a really, really good record. I'm kind of surprised it hasn't been the big breakthrough that I thought it would be, to be honest.
Well, it will be now because it's on Big Mouth.
It will be, yes.
I noticed that it does seem very, very now and very woke. And one of the singles was called "Don't Beat the Girl Out of My Boy." Yeah, think about it. Gender,
yes,
et cetera.
There's a lot of gender fluidity in there. I'd say that completely neutrally. I'm not taking any sides. But it's a great pop record. I mean, it's one of those things where you think about the seriousness of it, and it could be a bit off-putting. But it never seems off-putting when you listen to it. It seems like it's a piece of music above all else. You don't need to be caught up in the lyrics to gain enormous pleasure from the record.
She does seem to be a kind of a latitude draw. The kind of thing that, like, the dads are going to go and want to see Anna Calvi, but maybe the young people be interested as well.
I don't know. I suspect she's probably just more an old people draw at this point. it's one of the confusing things, actually, I think, is so often I go and see a lot of guitar bands because I like guitar bands. But so often you're watching some 20-somethings on stage and you look around the crowd and it's entirely men of my age. I think this is just so bloody depressing. But there have been a few times this year where I've gone to see groups and they have actually had young people there. The Magic Gang, who had an album out on Warner earlier in the year, they had 1,100 kids on each other's shoulders at the Electric Ballroom. Shame I've seen in London with a young crowd. Goat yeah. Girl get a young crowd, yeah. And I think that can only be a good thing if more young people are actually going to see. Well, if you like guitar bands, it's a good thing, but more young people are going to see guitar bands. And I went to see this group last night, Buzzard, 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 who look about 12, from Wales, and wear double denim and play this sort of arch glam rock, sort of like Gorky's doing Slade.
Okay. Can I get that?
Yeah. And there were girls dancing to Buzzard, Buzzard, Buzzard. Not very many, because there weren't very many people there, but there were girls dancing.
By the way, that's a 2018 thing, isn't it? Buzzard, 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 and also pigs, 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 pigs,
pigs. Pigs times seven, as we call them.
I thought they were called pigs, 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 pigs.
Pigs. Pigs, 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 pigs.
So this don't is this we need we need three bands, don't we, named after sort of multiples of animal to become trend.
There are when I first heard of Buzzard, 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 I was Googling them, and I did come across other bands called Buzzard, Buzzard and Buzzard. So you could have a bill of Buzzard, 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 and Buzzard, Buzzard, Buzzard.
Supporting Ozzy Osbourne's Blizzard of Oz and Budgie. I just wonder if that's going to be the Verve Curve swerve of now.
I mean, seamlessly enough, and there's potential for furtherance here. The town I was born in, as Sean mentioned earlier, Wagga Wagga, translates from the local Aboriginal language as many crows, because Wagga means one crow, and their way of pluralizing or expressing multiples was to double it.
Okay.
So there's room for exploration there if further bands are wishing to name themselves after the same name for an animal several times over.
Yeah. I feel we're all learning.
The power of.
Yeah. Crows to the power of crows.
Mouse to the power of 12.
Moving on.
To start. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Carry
quite
on,
right.
Carry on,
oh, moving on. Yeah, come on. You know, times are ticking. Michael, your television show of the year is the final series of The Americans, which is Russian spies in the US, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why have you chosen this, and can you explain why it's so great without destroying it for anybody who hasn't watched it yet?
Well, it wasn't just the final series of my TV show of the year, because I'd never watched any of it, and I'm flicking through, I think it was Netflix, or one of the streaming channels or something, one night I came across and thought, I'm going to start watching that, having no idea whereabouts it was in its run. And I watched the first five series in about 3 weeks, and then realised the final series was underway as well, so I watched that straight after on Amazon. And my first thoughts about the very first episode of the show were, this is a kind of high-class action thing of the week, you know, where there'll be a big chase and someone will get shot. And it's going to kind of like that. I'm not sure I'll persevere. But it's not about that at all. It's about relationships and loyalties, and how relationships are tested by cross-cutting loyalties across all levels of a family and within friendships. And it became extraordinarily powerful and moving the longer it went on. I mean, obviously, there was still espionage and tradecraft and people getting shot. But the final series kind of hinges on the married couple who are at the centre of it. The husband, who has got out of spying and now just running a travel agency completely legally in Washington, D.C., who is absolutely fed up of everything to do with the Soviet Union, and the wife, who remains loyal to the KGB, and the growing realisation that maybe, in fact, the KGB, it's like the David Mitchell thing, maybe we're not the good guys.
Yeah.
And it hinges on that, on what they decide to do with their lives. And I would recommend it to everyone. I don't want to give away any plot spoilers, because it should unfold before you. But if you haven't ever watched it, go back to the very beginning. It's on streaming services. Go back to the beginning. Watch it from the first series. You will not be able to stop.
But also, I suppose one of the benefits of this subject alone in particular is that... you know, it's all dramatic irony. We know they lose the Cold War. They're going to lose the Cold War. We saw it happen. So you've got that thing of people, you know, it came through in the trailer alone, the fact that people are genuinely committed to a system that's totally opposed to ours, and they really, really believe in it. And the great pathos of somebody attached to a doomed project. And of course, are they going to go down with the ship?
Of course. I mean, you see a lot of actual Americans, not just Russians, being American. You see a lot of Americans too. And there's the genuine paranoia they have, that which was true, that the Soviet Union was miles ahead militarily of where it really was. Each side's conviction that the other could possess deadly weapons that could destroy humanity at a click of a finger. There's a terrific book about all of that called The Dead Hand. I can't remember who it's by. I think it's by someone who worked for The Economist, actually. But it's called The Dead Hand, and it's basically a history of 80s nuclear paranoia. And it's fantastic, and you realise how insane it all was.
Well, I just visited the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in north of Los Angeles somewhere a couple of weeks ago. And if you want a hit of that, this is the place to go. You can also buy presidential Pez dispensers in the gift shop. Nixon, Carter... Gerald Ford, it's a full set of presidential things are available. But to go in there and to walk through the 80s again, and obviously from a very Reaganite point of view, There's no doubt at all. There's no light and shade here. This is good and evil. You come out with your own doubts, but to just be reminded of that when you've lived through it is quite a powerful thing.
Well, the series ends with Gorbachev having become ascendant in the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. And, you know, the suspicion of Gorbachev from the Soviet institution is the big political presiding theme of the final episode. And it's basically about, do we save Gorbachev or do we let him go? As well as being about all the family and the betrayal and the relationships.
And all
it has everything.
Things. Fantastic. And your movie of the year is Leave No Trace, which I'm completely ignorant of this. Can you set it up for us?
It's a film by Deborah Granick, who made Winter's Bone a few years ago. And it's another kind of outcast from society in rural America film. But it's about a father who's obviously maybe perhaps an Iraq veteran or an Afghanistan veteran, and his daughter. And the father's chosen to live completely outside the system. They are hiding out, camping in a park in the suburbs of Portland. When they get discovered and shunted off to live in some kind of semblance of straight society, which the father can't cope with, but the daughter finds increasingly attractive. You know, roofs and warmth and food that you don't have to hunt for yourself.
1975 streaming available on Spotify. Things like that. The teenagers like, yes.
And then they escape again. But there was a similar film 2 or 3 years ago starring Viggo Mortensen called Captain Fantastic that tackled some of the same themes and was quite enjoyable, but did it in a very kind of cartoony way. But there's nothing cartoonish about this. You absolutely believe in the characters, in the father and the daughter. And you're torn between, with the Viggo Mortensen one, it's kind of obvious. Hey, this fellow's a bit loopy. You're going to have to come to some compromise. But with the father and daughter in this film, there's very much you sympathise enormously with him. He's becoming capable of living in society. But at the same time, at one point, isn't an act of cruelty to prevent your children integrating with society. And it handles that question, you know, with such pathos, such empathy, and, you know, kind of with no hint of judging either one or the other. And the human relationships in it that they form with other people, even though they're fleeting, because it's a film and someone's in the film for 10 minutes and then goes, all of those relationships build into what the film is. It's wonderful.
I really loved Winter's Bone. I thought it was fantastic. That was Jennifer Lawrence's
first
film.
That's right, yeah. Well, it's her big breakthrough role,
And it's amazing. And it just shows you a side of America that seldom makes it to the screen, which we may be returning to later in the show in some of Andrew Mills' choices, but we also asked you for a non-categorisable other from the year. And amazingly enough, it concerns Hand Favourite, The Whole Steady. What's this all about?
What the Whole Steady do now, they don't tour like a normal rock band. They go to places where they can play for 3 or 4 nights, and they do that 4 or 5 times a year. They were in London in March. They were in Brooklyn at the end of November and December. And as I did last year, I went out to see them, went to all 4 nights in Brooklyn. Now, this isn't about loving The Whole Steady. It's about the experience of sharing something with different people over a prolonged period. And there is something magical about kind of following a group round. And the people you get to know, the experiences you have, and the sense that you bond, and the conversations you have. The final night of The Whole Steady, afterwards in a bar, I end up talking for a couple of hours to the British 57kg clean and jerk women's weightlifting record holder.
Okay.
Commonwealth gold medalist and 2012 Olympian, who'd also flown over from London for The Whole Steady show. So it's not just me. Olympians do it too. And those are the kind of things you don't get when you think, oh, fancy going to see that band tonight. When you make an effort, I think the rewards are commensurately greater.
There you go. Finally, your track of the year, another massive surprise. It's the 1975 with Love It If We Made It, which this actually appeared on the last 2 Big Mouths as well.
They
probably win the show or something. Michael, obviously you're a huge proponent of this. This is not a criticism. They are a teenager's band, massively popular with the young people. What connection are you making with the 1975 here?
I first wrote about 1975 on their first album, which I reviewed for The Guardian, expecting to hate it and end up being kind of really compelled by Matty Healy's Way With Words and the kind of the vaulting ambition that they have to just try and seize hold of things that might not always be within their grasp, which is something they haven't lost. What I think is fascinating about them is, as you say, they're a group for teenagers, but they're a weird art rock band for teenagers. All their influences are taken from, well, not all of them, because there are a load from 80s pop. There are a load of influences from weird art rock as well that are brought in there. And they're completely unfiltered, which I think is one of the reasons that they appeal to teenagers. You know, that I think they're kind of this glimpse into an adulthood that maybe they haven't yet attained. Although to be honest, they're going to be getting older now. Quite a lot of them will be adults. And, of course, the actual grown-ups have now seized upon them too. Hmm. But, yeah, I'd love it if we made it was one of the singles from their new album, Brief Inquiry into One-Line Relationships. And I just thought it was such a daring opening couplet. First for the first line, which in terms of a big teenage pop it is a bit, whoa, do you want to go there? And then the way it undercut itself. So it opens, we're fucking in a car shooting heroin. Then saying controversial things just for the hell of it. Great having your cake and eating it.
Yes,
there.
It's for pure cake. Yeah.
But I think the fact that they're willing to take chances to be a big pop group, and they are a big, big pop group, that there's no hint of focus groups or, you know, the label sitting down saying, lads, 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 this is what we need now. They're doing exactly what they want. And it always baffles me when people say, oh, Matty Healy just shouts his mouth off, what a twat. I mean, you spend half your time complaining that pop stars are too boring.
Yeah.
Then when someone comes along who isn't boring, you say, oh, shut up.
It's almost as if people like complaining about things, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's have a listen. This is Michael Hand's track of the year, the 1975, with Love It If We Made It.
Now, the Mueller inquiry.
Hey!
Ah, it's Andrew Mueller's turn. Will Andrew also choose exciting young person's electronic-tinged feelings music? Or will it be a little bit more country and a little bit more rock and roll? What do you think? Here's a selection of Andrew's favourites from the year. Firstly, A Very English Scandal, Russell T. Davis' dramatisation of the Jeremy Thorpe scandal starring Ben Whishaw and Hugh Grant. Then Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit with Cover Me Up from his album of the year Live from the Ryman. And there's a bit of the movie The Go-Betweens right here, a biopic of the Aussie band, which does what it says on the tin. Are you musical?
Four. Liberal Party.
What's your name?
Norman, sir.
Jeremy Thorpe is elected leader of the Liberal Party.
He was heaven.
You're the youngest man to lead a British political party in more than a century.
Careful now, I'm not sure any boy's worth ending up in prison for.
I was a victim.
My little bunny.
Of his lust.
He will destroy me and the party and my marriage.
You were amazing.
I was rude. I was vile. I was queer. I was myself.
Days when we raged, we blew off the page. Such damage was done. But I made it through, 'cause somebody knew I was meant for someone.
I can remember hearing the Go-Betweens for the first time on the radio. Hairs went up on the back of my, on my arms and the back of my neck.
On acoustic guitars, these two boys with their, you know, pathetic shirts and pathetic hair, and I thought, how daggy, how great.
They were going to be kings of the world, and so for a while it was all on.
It just seemed like that we were invincible. There was not one band that we thought were anything like us, and it scared us. We were troublemakers. We were dreamers. It took off from that moment.
Andrew Mueller's Stuff of the Year, A Very English Scandal, starring Hugh Grant as Jeremy Thorpe, Jason Isbell in the 400 Unit, and the Go-Betweens biopic right here. Let's start with A Very English Scandal. Give us the précis.
Everything about it's terrific. It's beautifully written. It's beautifully acted, especially by the two leads. And it's just, it was interesting for me, have, as an Australian who's lived in Britain for a long time, but not quite that long, that I don't have any particular understanding of what Britain was like during the period chronicled, that sort of 60s, 70s thing. And it did such a great job, I think, at least, of evoking that time and place. I would be interested to know whether English people thought the same. But I thought it was also especially timely in that we have learned so much in the last few years, I think partly because politics is more exposed than it ever has been before, about what an arena and sanctuary it is for extraordinarily dysfunctional people who would be pretty much unemployable in more or less any other line of work.
Yeah.
I can't be the only person who has spent a lot of the last few years sort of regarding the circus occurring in this country and in others, Australia not least among them. You just keep coming back to that thing of like, where do these people come from? Who votes for them? How do they get there? Why have we reached a point at which these are the people we're allowing to be in charge of things? I won't rehash the story too much because I don't want to spoil it for people who don't know it, and people who do want to know it can look it up. But it's a strange story full of, you know, furtive love and hitmen and dogs getting murdered.
Yes.
I think more or less by accident. But it all actually happened. And it's just an absolutely note-perfect dramatisation, I think. It would have been very, very easy to get it wrong, for all the characters to be played as ludicrous, absurd caricatures, and it's just not. And it's written and played so well that you end up feeling weirdly sympathetic to Jeremy Thorpe, who is really not at all a sympathetic character.
I thought that absolutely... Yeah, you feel... you know, Norman Scott is... not a very likable individual, but you admire his tenacity and his refusal not to, you know, his refusal to be, you know, bent out of shape and not be himself. And you weirdly admire, although he is a kind of a monster, Jeremy, or you feel at least sympathy for Jeremy Thorpe's, you know, frozen position in the days when the terror of being outed as gay. Was a life ender.
And it does leave as interestingly ambiguous, you know, Jeremy Thorpe is clearly portrayed in the thing as a fairly dreadful man who does some pretty terrible things. But then there is the question of 20 years later or 30 years later, or a Jeremy Thorpe character in the previous, or in the current day, does he get driven into those corners? Because if he's allowed to sort of exist and do his job and run for office in a world where he can just be himself and no one really cares.
Yeah.
Well, obviously there are always people in politics about whom there are rumours about their sexuality still. But now, that point about him doing these terrible things, I mean, it's Jeremy Thorpe kind of exists at this nexus of being powerful and connected and part of the establishment, but also part of another group that literally dare not speak its name. And that's what turns it all toxic, isn't it? It's the secrecy that does it.
He's trying to be the insider and the outsider at the same time.
And it can only be helpful to stop those kind of things happening again.
But also, the, you know, a big part of the thing is that he is kind of addicted to the, you know, the frisson of being in the outsider group while still an insider, and that's also what kind of undoes him, isn't it?
But this is a common sort of psychological assessment of people, you know, in politics, and there's always that question when some politician rather gets brought down by some absurd and obviously avoidable scandal. Which is not infrequent, but it is just that explanation that the kind of people attracted to a life in politics are the kind of people attracted to risk, and they're attracted to drama. And I think also you probably get to a point at which you think, you know, I'm an MP, I'm a party leader, I can do what I like. Who the hell do these people think they are?
Yeah.
Because Russell T. Davies is writing it, it's funny as well. So it's not a goodies versus baddies and
absolutely
high
not.
Drama. It's silly. There's this recurring thing that the national insurance...
If he'd only given me his national insurance number,
that would have
could all have been avoided.
Yes. So this autistic character, who's not, you know, he's not overtly autistic or something. You know, it gets revealed in these very, you know, in the slight, in the everyday, which is such good writing. Because it's been on this week as well, and there was a really good documentary about that they could only show this week about the Jeremy Thorpe scandal and what they know now as to what they knew before. And so I rewatched it again.
And Hugh Grant is superb, and I think actually has quite a lot of fun playing against his usual type. But I think that gives his performance added cachet, because you're so used to Hugh Grant playing this endearing floppy fringed fop.
But he knows that
of course
life
he does.
Of a politician, because of as we
of
know,
course
he's
does.
Been
he has divine insight into
indeed he does.
I remember very vividly from 1975. I think it was when the trial was. 6 years old, and seeing it on the news and asking my parents, why has a politician killed somebody's dog? I'm looking back on it now thinking, God, what must my parents be thinking? How do we explain this? How do we go into this? Well, he was really trying to kill the fella.
And really, it's because they were like, no, I think it was just, oh, I don't know. I think the dog tried to bite him.
Yeah. It would be.
Well, you can imagine certain conversations up and down the country where the takeaway from the kid was like, well, there are gay people and they all kill dogs. They're dog murdering homosexuals. Yeah.
Crikey. Mm. Moving on.
Yes.
Andrew, at your album of the year, Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit, live from the Ryman. Tell us about it.
It's a bit of a cheat on my part because it is a live album and it does consist but it consists of things obviously released in years other than this. But it's a fantastic live album. Jason Isbell has taken to doing a thing in recent years where he just, not dissimilar to what the Hold Steady have been doing, in fact, where he books himself into the venerable Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, former home of the Grand Ole Opry and basically country music's La Scala, and plays for sort of five or six or more nights at a stretch.
Right.
Obviously, he has enough people who wish to purchase tickets to see him do that to be able to do that. But I think I'm right in saying he does hold the record now for the longest continual stretch at the Ryman, which is no small change.
Tell us about his music, then.
Jason used to be the sort of third string songwriter in Drive-By Truckers, and he left the band under something of a cloud, though they all appear to be speaking to each other again now. His first couple of solo albums were okay-ish. They had good songs on them. Each one had sort of two or three really good songs on them. You can imagine getting on to a Drive-By Truckers record had he stayed in the band, and then a whole bunch of stuff which Drive-By Truckers probably wouldn't have wanted on their records. And then a few years ago, he made an album called Southeastern, which I think is on current form my single favourite thing of the entire 21st century. And it shouldn't have worked as a country record because it was a country record mostly about sobering up, pulling himself together, getting married to the love of his life and sorting himself out.
Yeah.
So the track I have selected, which is Cover Me Up, is also the opening track on Southeastern, and it's an absolutely unabashed love song to his wife, Amanda Shires. But the live version is fantastic because I don't think I've ever heard an audience respond to a song quite like this. It's not just they cheer the song when it finishes. They cheer every line while he's singing it. And I really don't think he's done any sort of Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison shenanigans and dubbed in applause at opportune moments. It's quite an extraordinary thing to listen to. Mm-hmm. And also the knowledge that while he's singing this absolutely unabashed song, you know, his missus is playing the fiddle behind him. It's quite a high wire act to walk, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's perhaps worth saying that the dramatic improvement in the quality of Jason Isbell's recordings did coincide completely with him stopping drinking.
It absolutely did. He would not dispute for a second.
I asked him about it. He said, well, why did things get so much better when you stopped drinking? So basically because I had more hours in the day, so I could actually, I was no longer obsessed with getting to the bar at the minute the clock turned five, so I could actually spend longer working on the songs, and incredibly that made them better.
What sort of message is that to send out to Christmas? Jesus.
Right, your movie of the year, Andrew, is The Go-Betweens right here.
Yes, I realise it's a shockingly predictable choice. It's somewhat limited, my choice of movie of the year, by the fact that, as I was explaining to Andrew by email earlier in the week, I don't really go to cinemas ever, because most films are terrible and they're full of the general public with their rustling of sweet wrappers and their phones and so on. But I did go and see this one in a cinema. It was the premiere of the film. It is a documentary about probably my favourite band ever, the Go-Betweens. But because of that, in fairness, I was always liable to judge it harshly if I thought it was not up to scratch.
Oh, I see, yes.
But it is well and truly up to scratch.
Well, the trailer implies that they're Australia's great lost band. Would you agree, or do you think enough people have heard of them?
It's true to an extent, and I know the band themselves are heartily sick of that characterisation. They were one of those perennial critics' favourites. Every time one of their albums came out, it got better reviews than Penicillin, and then nobody bought it, and then... This kept happening, which I know they... So, I mean, I got to know the two mainstays of the band, Robert Forster and Grant McLennan, quite well. Robert better than Grant. And the great melancholy overhanging the recognition they've enjoyed in recent years is that Grant died in about 2005, 2006, at a very young age, only 48, which did prompt a certain amount of acknowledgement. It was very weird. I think a lot of media organizations became aware that this thing was happening and just googled the Go-Betweens, and my name came up a lot. So
I ended up sort of, being interviewed on CNN, trying, just sitting there thinking, why does Grant have to die before CNN start doing things about what a great songwriter he was, and before the New Yorker do a profile of him, and before there's speeches on the floor of the Australian Parliament of this sort of great legacy the band left, and they've named a bridge after them in Brisbane.
Oh, wow.
And it's just... It's a great strangeness, I think, of the way the cultural media works.
Does the film reflect that then?
It does. The relationships within the band, you get the sense, are still a bit tetchy between the former members of the band. They were a band of let's call it forceful personalities, and there was something of a Fleetwood Mac vibe going on in terms of relationships among the members of the band. All of which worked out terrifically well in the long run. So I that takes a bit of getting past. But the fact that they got to do what they did and came from where they came from, Brisbane in the 1970s, and it's very hard to underestimate what a strange place Queensland was at around this period. It was a sort of weird, republic's the wrong word because the people in charge were very enthusiastic royalists. So it was a strange banana monarchy run by an extraordinarily conservative, deeply corrupt political machine, all of which fell to pieces in uproariously entertaining style eventually, and quite a lot of people ended up in jail. But the idea that two of the most influential Australian bands ever, the Saints and then the Go-Betweens, formed in Brisbane not long apart, you can argue cause and effect, I think, quite plausibly. Did these bands only form in Brisbane as a rebellion against what they were surrounded by? Which is plausible. But the film does such a great job of telling that story and getting the participants in it to tell their stories and framing them in context and coming across as... It would be very easy to sort of amplify the tragedy of no one ever paying attention to this band and certainly Grant dying very young, but it does come across as a celebration, and so it should.
How do we see it? Is it on DVD now?
I believe you can get it on the DVD and on the internet and all of that sort of thing. But I recommend it. As we all know, because I'm sure we've watched any number of such documentaries, it's very easy to make plodding, boring documentaries about bands. This is not one of those.
Great. Now, your other choice is a book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth, by Sarah Smarsh.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary book and one I liked very much because I became quite vexed with this genre of American journalism, which has developed in the time since Donald Trump was elected, and it has become an entire industry of, and I'm sure we've all read the pieces, where some big city reporter decides to go out into the states they spend the rest of their lives ignoring, talks to a few local people to ask why they voted for Donald Trump, and then comes back and writes this sort of beard-scratching piece about, I went to Nebraska and found it full of angry racists.
Toothless meth porn.
There was a writer at Deadspin who described the genre as the Cletus Safari, which is harsh but fair. And I became rather wearied of those. And the reason I like Sarah Smarsh's book so much is that she's writing that story, but it's her story. She's a fifth-generation Kansas farm girl who sort of discovered books at an early age and became a literature professor. And so she's written this book about her family and about her upbringing, and it's extraordinary. It's beautifully sketched. It's beautifully written. There's not a whisper of self-pity in it. It's occasionally very droll, very dryly funny in the way that people from the country generally often are. We had her on one of the shows I present for Monocle to talk about it, and she was, as expected, very interesting and very perceptive. The thing I couldn't quite think of a tactful way to say, so I didn't, but I only meant it as a compliment, but worried that it could be heard as otherwise, was that reading the book, you occasionally have to stop and remind yourself, she's writing about the 1980s. This is not a memoir of some sort of pre-Civil War life in the Appalachians.
Yeah, yeah.
This is happening in reasonably recent memory.
Yeah, have you read Hillbilly Elegy?
I have not.
I've read Hillbilly Elegy, but not this one, which by the sounds of it is a very similar thing. And yes, and I was struck by the same thing.
Yeah.
this fellow describing his childhood and thinking, and you really think, hang on, this is the 1940s. No, it's not. No, it's not. And also, we talked about hillbilly elegy in our book group, and I was struck by the reactions of many of the other people in my book group. Oh, it's a disgrace. You know, you can't say that. You know, that's just not. Hang on. He's actually there. He is a poor kid. It's no good you saying, no, that's not how it was for you growing up as a hillbilly in the South, because that's what it was.
We do live under a tyranny of did not happen right now. Pretty much anybody can volunteer a thing that really happened to them, and some dick on Twitter will pop up and go, didn't happen. There's even a Twitter feed called Did Not Happen, where people's lived experience, I believe it's known, is just routinely, debunked, just dismissed.
But this is a beautifully written lived experience, and it's structured around a narrative device which I kept expecting to overbalance, but which doesn't. It's sort of addressed as letters to the child she never had. And as she explains it, she sees that in itself as kind of a triumph, because she comes from a long line of unmarried teenage mothers. So there's an awful lot in there of not just about how growing up poor and rural imprisons you and defines you, but how growing up female in America can imprison you and define you as well. And it was one of those books that once you put it down and digest it, even if you don't necessarily agree with everything in it, you don't quite stop thinking about it.
Right.
There's quite a lot of, oh yeah, I hadn't really thought of it that way before, going on, which I think is, it's not a common thing to be able to do. It's a terrific book, and absolutely one I will go back to at some point, I think.
Wonderful. Now, we're going to have a listen to Julia Jacklin with Head Alone. That's your track of the year. Just tell us quickly what this is.
It's a bit of a cheat in terms of track of the year as well, because, I mean, this track is out, the album off which it is of, and that's the album from which it is off of is not out until February, though I have heard it and can vouch that it's all excellent. Julia Jacklin's first album of a few years back, called Don't Let the Kids Win, was one I was entirely entranced by, despite really not expecting it to be, because once I'd got my head around the fact that, like, so hang on, this is an album soundtracking the existential angst of a 24-year-old who's worried that she hasn't, you know, that she's underachieved and isn't accomplishing everything. It's like, yeah, cry me a damn river.
Let me tell you about that love. Hang on a minute.
Exactly. But the album was the songs on it were so perfectly poised, so witty, surprisingly wise in stretches, and It reminded me quite a lot of Liz Phair before she completely lost her way, which is extremely high praise. And the new album, though, it has been a while in the writing, and it turns out, because we did a session with her at Monocle not long ago, and she did explain that after that album came out, she got seized with a sort of secondary bout of existential angst. So having made the album that she was worried she hadn't made, she then got sidetracked by worry about never getting to do another one, because she wasn't sure if she'd remembered how to write songs anymore, but it turns out that she very much does. She is one of those people, I think, perhaps like Polly Harvey or Anna Calvi, who we were talking about earlier. It might take 3 or 4 albums, but if she gets to make those 3 or 4 albums, I would be unsurprised by her becoming a very, very big deal.
Julia Jacklin with Head Alone. That's Andrew Mueller's track of the year. And now it's Sian's turn to tell us about the best of 2018, because I'm going to get my go next week. Sian, we've got just a couple of your choices here, and here we go. This is Make Me Feel by Janelle Monáe from your album of the year, Dirty Computer, and the trailer to Spike Lee's Black Klansman.
Did you get the answers to my confessions? It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better.
There's never been a black cop in this city. We think you might be the man to open things up around here.
This is Ron Stallworth calling.
Well, who am I speaking with?
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
God.
Last time I checked. What can I do for?
Well, since you asked, I hate blacks. I hate Jews, Mexicans, and Irish.
Italians and Chinese. But my mouth to God's ears, I really hate those black rats. And anyone else, really, that doesn't have pure white Aryan blood running through their veins.
I'm happy to be talking to a true white American.
God bless white America.
America first.
America first. America first.
If I would have known this was a Klan meeting, I wouldn't have taken this mother.
Jean, your stuff of the year, Dirty Computer by Janelle Monáe. What did you love about that?
Yes, it's because, like a lot of albums of this year, it's a bit like, oh my God, what of a state are we in? You know, the Trump stuff, you know, we have Brexit, they have Trump, the American people. And, I mean, it really is, oh my God, what do I do? What do I do? Do I make a really depressing album about how everything is really, really shit? No, I'm going to make the most glorious, fuck you, joyful, fantastical record. Yeah. It's about me, you know, being saucy in a swimming pool all the time. It's incredibly saucy music. And I think she's an absolute superstar. And it's one of those things that will cheer you right up if you...
It is the revolutionary resistance proportion aspect of having a good time, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, because it's political in every sense. It's political, it's personal, it's political with a big P as well. It's about Janelle Monáe saying, actually, look, this is the kind of human I am. If you're a bit strange and a bit, you know, you have some peccadilloes that you would like to put on record, this is her. I'm very bad at talking about things I like, have you noticed? I just sort of froth, but I find... Yeah.
Well, if I froth away, she has kind of translated herself. She has translated herself into the major leagues, hasn't she? Is she?
Yes.
When it came out,
and so she should.
Everybody went Prince, Prince, Prince. But is she actually Prince yet? Is she Prince now?
I think she is getting quite princey because she's got Wonderland. So she's got, which she makes films with, and it's a record label too. So she's going to sign people. She's going to be that mini despot in a really good way. And she has her acolytes. She wants the mini empire, and I think she should. I think she is incredibly powerful as a person.
She also seems
in a really
to be
good pop star way, you know.
She also dresses
as a vagina. I mean, that's
hooray for that.
Isn't it?
Yeah, she does seem to be properly mental in a way that pop stars ought to be.
And glorifying.
We're just talking about how bad it is that politicians are mental and pop stars aren't. Yeah. It should be the other way around.
Yes.
Politicians should be sensible and pop stars should be crackers, and she seems to be properly crackers.
I think she is properly crackers and is more celebrating, whereas the other albums were a bit meeker, I think, in a sort of as a whole view. This is her saying, I am going to be this storming person and I am going to be the weirdest person in the room and get used to it. I mean, it's hits, hits, hits as well on the record. It's not a dull moment on there. So you've got Pink and then you've got Make Me Feel and you've got I Like That. Well, it's just, it's a celebration of that oddness, and that's what Prince had, you know, that eccentricity and the weirdness. Make that your thing. Make it and do it.
She would have been great smash hits material, wouldn't she?
Oh, fantastic.
What would you have done with her?
She would have wanted to put a baguette on her head, you know.
Yes.
All the things that we made, usually Johnny Hates Jazz, I think, made them do. She would have wanted to dress up as Father Christmas for the cover, I would imagine. And she would have bought a load of sort of black power women to stand in the background and look really good
at
the same time. I think she relishes in that and likes. It's nice when you have pop stars who like the attention, who want the attention. They're not going to sort of shy away and be very, very serious and talk about how terrible Trump is. She just wants to get out there, I'd say, dressed as a pink vagina.
And who doesn't? Your movie of the year was the amazing Black Klansman, which I really enjoyed as well. What did you love about
Black
Klansman?
I've got a bit of black power for this one.
You totally have.
But it was one of those, when you get
Sean
out of... wonderful. When you get out of the cinema and you immediately want to phone everyone you know and go, I've just seen this amazing film. It is, you know, you've got to see it absolutely now. That's what that film made me want to do. It is a film by Spike Lee. It is funny as well as about serious matter, about the black cop who infiltrates the KKK. Hilarious at points and then very, very deeply disturbing, especially there's a scene about the lynching, the lynchings of black men, and which is just everybody in the movie stopped. And then we have the footage of Charlottesville at the end, mobile footage, which I was in a cinema and the whole place just stopped. And it was very, very difficult not to cry at some of that footage. Yeah. You have this mainstream film. Here it is. It's a bit slapdash. It's a buddy movie, all that sort of thing. And then you have Charlottesville mobile footage.
Well, the amazing thing about it, I thought, was how it handled the switches in tone. Because something that is playing as really quite broad comedy shouldn't then be able to go to quite serious stuff about racial politics in America without it being jarring. Yet it somehow managed it. And you didn't feel guilty when you then went back to the laughs as well. But as you say, the Charlottesville stuff at the end, the screening I was in, the cinema, you could hear lots of crying during that footage, you know. amidst the silence.
I thought that thing about tone was really interesting, because large chunks of it are straight up blaxploitation cliche, but by the juxtaposition and the fact that it's placed in context, it redeems it from cliche. So instead of being predictable, it becomes like it becomes an element of Black American culture brought in to tell this story about the silencing, oppression, and so on of Black American culture. I thought it was fantastically clever, really exciting, very, very funny. I also thought one aspect of it that was really good was he has to use Adam Driver as his kind of white guy avatar to go amongst the Klan, and is effectively kind of, you know, whispering in his earpiece on this kind of thing. I thought that was a really modern thing, because it's Avatar.
Yeah.
It's like you are becoming another person.
Yes, identity, isn't it? Because it's all about identity and who plays it. And also you have the Ku Klux Klan members who are not played either as the most evil people in the world and full of power, and they're not given the slapstick treatment either. They're somewhere in between. They're just quite flawed and quite lost. And it could have been played as they're either they're going to kill us all, or they're just stupid people, just don't even worry about them. And the elements of that, as I say, it's all about the balance and the tone, is just masterful.
It is masterful. Mm. Now, your TV show of the year, we didn't have a clip of it because there's no way of getting a clip of Series 3 of The Good Place without totally spoilering it. So can you tell us why it's amazing without totally spoiling it?
Because The Good Place is not a dystopian TV programme. And I think we've all seen a year of dystopian TV programmes. It is a sitcom, and it is the one that I have stuck with. Usually I just leave them in about the middle of the series. But we're on Series 3. Watch them every week. It's also about philosophy. Again, it's about identity. It's Dante's Inferno, but given Ted Danson treatment.
Danson's Inferno.
Nice one. There's jokes about determinism in it. And there's jokes about fatalism. Jung is then, you know, dropped in there. And what I really like about it is it's a sitcom, and yet it's dealing with philosophical ideals.
So the people who don't know, it's essentially it's the afterlife, and the afterlife turns out to look like...
We try not to do spoilers, aren't we?
Yeah,
very much.
It's just the afterlife, and it looks like, and the afterlife turns out to be a Michel Gondry movie. Extreme but very concrete, realistic, brightly coloured surrealism, and insane things happening. I mean, and I love it because it's essentially, it is a sitcom with the budget of a gigantic hallucinatory Willy Wonka style fantasy movie.
I like the idea of Ted Danson being in heaven, only in as much as I like the idea that what actually happens when you walk through the pearly gates is everyone just calls your name in Norm fashion. that would be brilliant.
But isn't that effectively Cheers was supposed to be heaven anyway, wasn't it? Cheers was supposed to be The Good Place.
Oh,
we
nice.
Could go and you know, be safe, and everybody knows your name and that kind of thing. Media studies there. So the Good Place is on Series 3 right now, and it's almost impossible to discuss it any further without kind of ruining it a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not at the end of Season 1, hence my limited questions on the subject.
Yes. Oh, it gets more interesting, and they just have to play about with the idea of these characters and whether they are here or not, whether they are good or bad or something else.
There you go. Finally, your track of the year is Lemon Twigs and Small Victories. Why is this?
Lemon Twigs are a band who... are two brothers. They are the geekiest brothers you've ever seen. They're still about 3 years old, about 20. And they play Todd Rundgren style. So, you know, they're everything I would hate on a piece of paper. Rundgren, they noodle. And they're really, really odd little orchestral bits in the
This
in
is
the
literally
songs
the first time a girl has ever spoken about them.
Maybe not, though. And yet, I love them. They wear huge flares. They look like if the Manics had been brought up in sort of New York City somewhere along the line.
Is it like if the Manics stayed in the...
But yeah, they look really 70s. They look like they've come out of a bad blaxploitation movie. And they're so gawky and geeky. And then they play and they have these fantastic voices. And there's a lot of scissor kicking when
they seem to
stage.
Be immensely cheerful.
Yeah, it's that escape. We have politics. We've got Brexit. Sometimes you just want to listen to something else. Mm. And this is from the album, which is a concept album about a monkey who goes to school and bad things happen. And his parents have to deal with having a monkey and giving him bananas for breakfast. And Todd Rundgren is on it, the album.
There you go.
They're called Brian and Michael.
They are called Brian and Michael.
When I stood at The Guardian, I sent Alexis Petridis to interview them, who, whereas they were called Brian and Michael, his opening gambit was, "Blimey, you've changed since Pictures of Match Talk, mate." Which obviously didn't go down at all well with two 19-year-olds who had no idea what he was talking about.
But I'm sure that they went away and looked it up and were delighted. Well, we're going to play out with Lemon Twigs and Small Victories in a minute, because this is pretty much the end of the show and the end of the first of our Best of 2018 specials. Next week, it's the turn of Miranda Sawyer, Eamon Ford and me, so brace yourself. Andrew Mueller and Michael Hann are going to stick around for the extra bit for our Patreon backers. Thanks for coming on the show, chaps. Happy Christmas and Winterval and other things. You're off to Australia to hide from here. What are your Christmas plans, Michael?
Well, I'll be at the City Ground on December 22nd watching QPR see if they can get their first ever win away at Nottingham Forest in, I think, 34 attempts now. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be slumping in front of the television, largely in London, wondering why there's nothing on but being too lazy to pick up the remote control and switch to Netflix.
The true meaning of Christmas there. Thanks for coming on the show, chaps. Thanks to Sean and to producer Elsie Bath. We're going to see you all next week for the last show of 2018. In the meantime, here's Sean's track of the year, The Lemon Twigs, with Small Victories.